can't cross-question it. Who wants to have a go?
Who dare have a go?
My goodness.
I'm not going to cross-question, but I'd like to particularly thank Janice for her contribution. I think she was the only person to actually use the word consumer. And while very interested in what everyone said, I was sitting wondering, how much do you in your work think of consumer? I think the answer from Michael, but how much is the question of consumer, public support, important to your work and important to the work that we're doing here as well? Because, for example, I was interested in Jeff's, what he described as small and present focus. Now that to me sounds super lovely, wonderful, but would it do to the people on the high street who are going to be the consumers of whatever happens in the future?
I think we'll take it as a directive to somebody in particular. That would really help the conversation. So, Janice, could you briefly come back, and Jeff, could you briefly do say something
The evidence is that consumers have an extraordinarily powerful role to play if somebody is there to support their decision making and provide them with good quality information. You talk to anybody in the retail sector and they'll say, we respond to consumer demand. If consumers want products from X or Y or like this or from this production system or that production system, we'll stock it. That's our business. And the evidence is that they're extraordinarily responsive. The problem is that we don't have the labelling right and we don't have the pricing right. So products that should not be on the shelves because essentially they're unsustainable or come from unsustainable production systems, there's no way the consumer knows that or can see it. The information's not there, the price doesn't signal it. Eating less, higher quality food would take a lot of pressure off the land.
Jeff, anything to that?
The point I was focusing particularly was related to the point made across the table by my colleague that most of the world's food is actually produced by small and peasant farmers. And if we're to achieve this objective that you lay out, it's increasing their ability to continue to do that and have better livelihoods and better lives through the kind of support we give. The food that is traded, I think, will change in the time frame that you've got. And consumers are not... are actively massaged and influenced and marketed to and shaped what we do. And we all have customer profiling cards in our pockets, probably, from different... consumers, it's a dynamic, but it's consumers acting as citizens, actually shaping the rules, I think, that will really make the difference to the future and whether you achieve those goals.
Okay. Sue, Alan, and then Jeff, and then John. Yeah.
In one way or another, you all mentioned the potential of agri-ecological vehicles and the way that those should be developed. Do you think the gap in understanding what those even are that exists in the donor country is one of the issues that stops the development of that route?
Who's going to take that? Who's the best at it?
Two very important things to understand is... the term itself is probably a handicap because it sounds old-fashioned, and it's not. It requires the most extraordinary sophisticated science and understanding to understand the implications of going down that route. A lot of it also depends, and we have big arguments, perhaps not so much under the change of government in America, but under the previous administration, who believed that the agroecological diversity could be sustained at very large landscape scales. So you could have millions of hectares of monoculture, maize and soya, and then a patch of wilderness, and then, and that seemed to suit their history, but the evidence scientifically is actually against them. Smaller patches of agroecological quality is probably the most resilient. But it's always a question, in a particular context, do you need to do that within the field? Do you need to do that within the farm enterprise? Do you need to do it within the catchment or whatever? And that's very important because it affects the micro rules of the game. for example, seed systems are registered under the rubric of new seeds must be distinctive, uniform and stable. But as we head into a climate-changing world that's much more carbon-constrained and phosphorus-constrained, we are going to need to get back into the crop a much more diverse seed. And the UK government has actually been experimenting with to what extent can we bend the DUS rules in order to get diversity back into a commercial modern crop. But this is happening all the time, and Jeff has a lot to say about how the current rules actually prevent us going down that rule road around the world.
Thank you. Just
let me take these two first, then you. The way to do it for me is catch my eye if you want to say something, and I'll keep it brief.
Thank you. A very quick point. It's our experience that there is a gap between the theory underpinning much donor intervention and government policy and the practice on the ground. Various people have said this afternoon that agriculture is different in different places. It's specific to climate circumstances, to product circumstances, to regional geopolitical circumstances. So one size does clearly not fit all. And a particular example, Renwick, I'm sure you can speak more eloquently about this than me, is about the advice around diversification. You know, the theory is if you're producing in a sector which is in oversupply, you should diversify. Now, Tradecraft's been working very closely with tea producers in India. Now, there are particular cultural and historical circumstances around the tea gardens, none of which are desirable, but you cannot tell a producer who has been involved in, you know, who is tending 75-year-old bushes to diversify overnight. It just doesn't happen. And I'm sure the same is true in bananas.
Yes, yeah.
And just to inform you, unfortunately, I have to leave in the next 5 minutes. I have to go to Cardiff. But just to say, in terms of that, first of all, it is a reality because we were driven into monocrop. We had a diversified food production system. We were driven into monocrop production from... Well, I like to say that the Caribbean is the first experiment in globalization, in that it's where Europe, Africa, Asia, everybody came together with the land of the Caribbean to produce specifically for trade. Now, that disrupted our normal system. And now, when we have come across the problems, particularly mentioned in the banana world, you hear this talk, well, why you don't produce something else? There are two things here. First of all, our population, our farming population, like farming population all over the world, is increasingly an aging population. You take a farmer who is 55, who has been farming maybe for 40 years on his land, limited educational opportunities. And in today's world, you're talking overnight, but why don't train them to do something else? I mean, where is the something else, right? And therefore, for us, the diversification is, first of all, the connections I was speaking about in terms of connecting with food, but also importantly, the Caribbean is an important growth industry for tourism. And again, unfortunately for us, we are judged by GDP and statistics like these. Tourism brings in far more money on paper than agriculture, but most of it goes back out because a lot of the hotels are foreign owned, first of all, but most importantly, most of the food consumed in the hospitality industry are imported. All the cruise ships come down there, they come loaded, they don't buy anything, they come to our shows, they don't buy anything. And in fact, it has reached a stage at some large hotels. There's a particular case in St. Lucia. I don't know how many of you have visited, but the north of St. Lucia is where the tourism is concentrated. There is the Soufre and the Pitons down in the south. And the people of Soufre, when in the earlier days of tourism, used to bring their products. So when tourists come, they'll be able to sell something. Increasingly, the large hotels are doing their whole package tours. So when the small boat brings a lunch, brings the tourists, they have their lunches and everything else so that there's no connection. And so for us, that diversification also means a connection between agriculture and industry. And finally, I would like just to go back to the consumer point, because I think it is critical for us. Our success in fair trade expose a lot to the choices of the British consumers. But I think it would be, I think it's important to make the point of the power of the supermarkets and what they can do in terms of their own choices. We have had to get some of the supermarkets to sell fair trade bananas, literally to go outside their supermarkets, to do petitions, to get groups that we work with, Fair Trade Foundation, Oxfam, Christian Aid, Tradecraft, and so on, to join us in lobbying them to say that consumers want fair trade bananas. So I think it's also a very important aspect if we're looking at the food security and everything else, particularly in Europe. That aspect of supermarkets and consumer choice is also an important one.
I wanted to ask you a question, because you raised a subject that I think is fundamental and which is really important when you have to find answers to. When you said that you can get chicken and rice very cheaply in your open state, and yet for nine times what you can get locally produced nutritious fish. Now, there is absolutely no doubt that faced with that kind of choice, families can feed everyone for $4 or $5, and it costs so much to buy nutritious food. How can we change that? Well, we can't even change it in our own country, because we found this with the health select when we were looking at obesity. And actually, McDonald's and various other kinds of hamburgers are a cheap way to feed a family. And yet, with all our sophisticated ways of communicating with people in this country, we still can't get people to make that choice. How on earth can we do it on a world scale?
Another one.
And that's not really for a
Yeah,
and
right.
Yeah. Nick? So I've got one more significant question. My question is very much related to this one. And I was taken by Janice's comparison of input and output with a small farmer. They pay retail prices for input and only get up wholesale prices for the output. And that is exactly the November example, exactly that. But what I'd like to know is how can we increase the output of small farmers, give them a better return, without indulging in price manipulation, which is actually a support which may well run against
But is it possible to send
Yeah, you can write this. We'll write it to you, okay? But you haven't answered, you have some ideas for
yes.
that.
Yes. Let me thank you once again.
Okay, Randy. Have a safe trip to Cardiff. Okay. Okay. Did somebody else Janice,
good luck, huh? Yes.
Did you want to answer?
Briefly. It's not just donors, it's government officials who've all gone through the same education I went to when I did soil science and I worked in agricultural extension projects. You discount the knowledge of rural people and small farmers. There's a huge problem in the way we do our education. And then that links into what Lord Ray was just talking about. And if you look at the work of Niels Rowling and others who've worked on innovation systems in small farming, a lot in Africa, a new book on innovation agriculture in Africa, I'll leave some references for you. You have to understand what the few and specific opportunities of small farmers are and work with them to design your systems. If you're in a research station and you're doing stuff and the farmers around you are not copying it, it's not their problem, it's yours. You don't understand the constraints they're facing. There's a lot of work that you can pick up on from Ethiopia, from Latin America, from different places. There are plenty of examples. But to do it, it's more difficult, it takes more time, and it takes a lot more thinking.
Yes, I think there's quite a lot that you can do to promote the situation of small farmers within current trade regulations. First of all, there has been a a tendency to roll back from any kind of promotion of small-scale enterprise over the last few years, and that needs to be reversed. So there are a number of commitments by developing country governments to promote small-scale enterprise in some way, very few of which have come to pass. There was an interesting example in Kenya. The government of Kenya had a sessional paper on the role of SMEs in Kenyan agriculture, with a number of proposals to provide technical and financial support, to provide market linkages, to encourage big business when sourcing in Kenya to source a proportion from small-scale enterprise. That never came to anything. And there are a number of initiatives like that around the world which could do with being given a rather more profile and rather more commitment. Equally, within trade policy proposals on the table at the moment, with trade negotiations, there could be a commitment to identify the role of small-scale enterprise and promote it. And one other thing about this, if it's felt that an artificial promotion of small-scale enterprise would go against current WTO provisions, we could always revise the WTO provisions. We all talk about rewriting the rules.
Why overnight?
Well, you know, but at the moment we have nothing of any value, do we, on that?
No.
Very specific, relating to small farmer opportunities and WTA rules. Doha Round has already conceded, in specific circumstances and for temporary periods that can be negotiated, non-reciprocal access and special treatment. And these are really important regulations, concessions, because the evidence is quite clear that complete transition to open markets in agriculture and food, that developing countries with large export sectors, though not necessarily small farmers within them, have derived some benefits from this, but small farmers in the poorest developing countries have been net losers under every liberalization scenario that has been addressed this question. We can also do a lot to continue to press for a reduction in escalating tariffs for processed foodstuffs and products. There is absolutely no chance that significant value-adding will develop in many developing countries as long as these tariffs are in place, both between countries and from developing countries to our part of the world. It can be done. Change the, if the rules don't lead you where you want to get to, there's no other route but change the rules.
Quite.
Okay. Olivia?
Three very brief points. First of all, on an answer to the reason why agroecological alternatives have not been explored, I think, first of all, there is a widespread but wrong prejudice that these modes of production, despite their more social and environmentally sustainable dimensions, would not suffice to feed the planet. This is wrong. In fact, the studies are more and more being produced showing that agroecological modes of production can produce significantly more, particularly for small-scale family farming. A second reason is I think the private sector is not very interested in supporting this kind of production, simply because the benefits are widespread and public, and they cannot be easily captured in the form of patents or new markets for agricultural inputs. So there is less support from our side for these modes of production. And thirdly, I think it is in many cases more difficult to integrate global supply chains by agroecological modes of farming because they are mostly polycropping, and therefore it is more difficult perhaps to meet volumes and standards requirements which are required in global supply chains for those producing with those agroecological modes of production. That is to answer your question. Secondly, there was a question concerning what I call the addiction to cheap food of developing countries, cheap food which they buy on the international markets, which is heavily subsidized, and which is cheap simply because of the very important levels of support we provide our farmers in OECD countries, which artificially lead to dumping cheap food on the international markets. I think countries, developing countries, all too often have sacrificed their long-term interest in building robust agricultural systems to their short-term interest to buy cheap food on international markets of agricultural commodities. It is urgent now that we reinvest in agriculture in developing countries, boosting investment in services and infrastructures, but it's also important, as Jenny says, that we that these countries diversify themselves in order to be able to process food and not to be obliged to sell bulk commodities and buy processed food which is sold on the shelves in the supermarkets there, because this is highly unequal, and the tariff peaks which are practiced currently are a serious problem. But let me say this. Despite the fact that current agricultural trade is very severely distorted by difficult access to markets for many products from developing countries, by important domestic support to our farmers, and by export subsidies, which are still in existence, it will not do simply to remove these distortions. This will not solve the problem. The main problem, as I see it, is that the international division of labor between developing countries and developed countries is a source of extensive inequality, both within and between countries. Essentially, what is happening is that developing countries are asked to specialize in agriculture, which has decreasing returns. In other terms, it is more costly to produce, you know, the supplementary ton per hectare if you produce agriculture, whilst we produce manufactured goods, we produce services which have increasing returns, so that the more you produce and the cheaper the marginal unit you produce will be for you to produce. And so this leads to a system in which international division of labor leads to certain countries specializing in gaining and other countries specializing in losing. And I believe it's hugely important not to simply bet on the Doha development round, which is premised on the idea that it is efficient and that all will gain from more trade liberalization. It is not sufficient simply to ensure that agricultural production in developing countries has better access to our markets and that distortions are removed. It's important that these countries can protect not only their agriculture, but also can diversify into industry and services. And I produced a report on the WTO which explains this in some detail.
Alan and then John.
But doesn't that actually go back to the Doha agreement? The countries can find it possible for them to make added value products from their agricultural products if the tariff values come down. So that doesn't in itself give a boost. The tariff barriers for them to send the added value goods to the north or the west.
Well,
is that in short a step towards industrialization, improvement, increased income?
Michael, you want to say this one?
Yes, unless you want to go first.
Yep, please.
I think in theory that's right, but in practice, often it is too big a leap. There is some evidence now that the way to do that, the way to provide for that, is to provide for the growth of domestic and regional markets and regional cooperation before you go to full-scale intercontinental export. And that's being undermined at the moment by current trade policy. It's very hard for developing countries to regionalise.
Sam Hamilton is in the otherwise briefly Pendergrove, which is the second
serious mistake.
That's what I'm going to get. I just think one of the great problems is the self-deluding premise that the present, continuation of the present, is any way into the future. The remit that you were given about future policy, for me, you know, some of the questions, I just think that our only prospects of a sustainable path to the future are going to be determined by how quickly we tear up the existing rules base and how quickly we face the reality of the fact that there is no way the planet will feed 9 billion people by 2050, there is no way that the planet will sustain itself beyond 2 degrees rise in temperature this century. And if that is where we're heading, then we're stuck. So against that scenario, it's a row back and row differently set of questions. Two specific ones. Yesterday, panel member used the word resilience. It seems to me that the entirety of our agricultural futures are going to have to be determined around the set of resource constraints, some of which you explicitly to do with water limits, soil fertility, peak phosphate, peak oil, and everything has to be rethought around that. When I was talking with people from Cuba about how they've gone through their special period to become self-sufficient in organically produced food, one of the things that they said in pretty stark terms is that apart from near starvation the first couple of years, it was a profound shift in the allocation of labour time. Now 20% of the entire population of labour time goes into food production in cities as well as in. And what are your assessments about that as a developed world trauma, as what, much more I think than a developing world trauma? The second question is arising out of what I think is going to have to be a new sort of global mutualism. I was involved in one of the last Terra Madre conferences about the pooling of information about sustainable and localized businesses. The difficulty comes that people have a terrific record of conserving their own ecological history, but no idea about the pooling that is going to be required when their ecological past is not going to be their ecological future. Climate change will actually require us to see that we are the custodians of other people's ecological futures. So how does this require a new international mutualism that gifts freely the climate change food production knowledge from one part of the planet to another part of the planet, which will inherit that those climatic features and pass on the ones that will replace them?
Before you say anything, John, keep losing quick if you may never get a chance.
Well, no, I was very struck by what Ronnie Rose said in his earlier introduction remarks that, for example, small farmers need to get control of their own destiny, and they're fed up with having packages imposed on them which are impractical, which won't work, and are far out of the ground by regulations from elsewhere. And that one size doesn't fit all. We've said that many times, and we all recognize it. If you're talking about food production, you're going to have to look at local specific solutions, and the farmers themselves are going to have to get control as to what the relevant technology that they think is relevant, and they're likely to know much better than anyone else is. So the question then is, how do you put in place structures which empower the local producers and which ensure that the benefits which there clearly are from around the world of appropriate technologies which can be identified, tweaked, adapted, how can you ensure that these are made available? And I think it's a very relevant question for the United Kingdom, because although we complain about our agricultural research base having declined, which it has, it is still strong in global terms, and there's a lot of very relevant research. I think someone mentioned Rothamsted, we've mentioned many other sites, where indeed that's just happening. I mean, Kenya, there's some very good programs which of integrated pest management, which are based on really state-of-the-art work at Rothamsted. So my question is this, we've heard a lot of what is wrong, we've heard a lot of what could be wrong. What I'd like to know is where do we look for best practice? Where have you an example, to use Jeff's word, we need less supine governments. Where do we have a less supine government who has empowered the local producers, taken advantage of the technology which is out there? Water conservation, for example, I've seen in Tanzania, the Israelis doing excellent work, telling people how to grow crops in the way that the Israelis have led the way on, with very minimal water requirements. Are there other examples that we should be alerted to? Who is doing it best?
There's two excellent questions for you. Who's going to start? Is that you, Michael?
Okay,
very... It's hard to answer them all, but...
The key, exactly as Renwick said, is talk to the producers themselves. And of course that's hard to operationalise at a global level, but there are ways into this. In the fair trade sector, the fair trade supply chain involves a lot of participation around setting price, agreeing terms of trade, agreeing pre-order finance, a sort of dialogue up and down the chain in terms of information. That's one thing. One of the things that we know about from colleagues in outside of fair trade supply chains is that producers simply don't know about market peaks in their commodities. So, you know, a coffee grower won't necessarily know what's going on in the coffee market globally, so they don't know whether they're going to get a good or bad price. So dialogue is exceptionally important. It's worrying that so much. One example, the EU-India trade agreement, which is happening at the moment, a free trade agreement being negotiated between the EU and India, doesn't involve any small-scale producer consultation. Nobody is asking them for their opinion about what this might do to their viability. Therefore, they don't know about it, they don't have a chance to input. So there should be those kinds of mechanisms built into these kinds of policies. I think we need to look at developing more traceable supply chains. So the bigger companies, the retailers typically, disclose information around their supply chains, you know, to do with not just economic but social and environmental performance too. There's the bones of a proposal here within the Companies Act that went through Parliament recently for directors to disclose not just economic materiality in their company reporting, but also environmental and social materiality, including their relationship with their suppliers. That may start to unblock this sort of power logjam, if you like. There's also an opportunity with the, thinking of the UK market, the current Competition Commission recommendation for a grocery sector code of practice, which would bind the UK supermarkets and their suppliers into a written enshrined code of practice. And also the Competition Commission critically has proposed an ombudsman, a place of safety where suppliers could go to table what they perceive to be violations against that code without fear of being delisted. So this culture of fear, where one player in the supply chain has vastly more power than the others, could start to be addressed. Small initiatives, but through those kinds of approaches you get dialogue, which is the way forward.
Jeff and Janice, Angela, you're all nodding and Alan is speaking as well, so try and combine the answers, please.
Right.
Jeff, you start, yeah.
Okay. I agree we need different rules, but we can feed 9 billion in 2050, but not if we go on as we are. And it depends on what diets we're talking about and where we're having. I think the issues there on exchanging knowledge, absolutely central, and this is why the expansion of intellectual property is crucial. It's undermining that whole thing. It's causing the issues around biopiracy are causing reactions in other countries. There's an old book you can read here about some of this, but the way we're going with intellectual property, and assuming because you can protect something or copyright it or patent it, that is going to bring you the kind of innovation we need, is wrong, I'd say. It will not work for what we're trying to seek. And there's a whole lot of reasons why. And there are people doing it, there is different traditional knowledges being collated, and there are people aware of what you're talking about. The International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources is an attempt to have a common space where we share the genetic resources. It was very difficult to do, not everyone has signed up to it, and it is that sense of we need commons, lots of different commons, sharing knowledge commons and sharing genetic commons and so on, if we are to have the adaptation we need for climate changes. I think we need to look at who gets the money when we look at this transparent. I'd like to see actually on your shelf, okay, this banana cost a quid, the producer got a penny, the supermarket got 50p, actually we don't have anything like the kind of transparency that you would. This is gone under concerns of commercial confidentiality and so on, but there are different things we could do there. Finally, the UK really should use and some of the great things it has done, like the Commission on Intellectual Property Rights, the best thing that the UK ever set up on the IP area. Got a very great deal of response from developing countries, and we've not done very much about it since it's happened. And we could, you know, we were the first into the Industrial Revolution, but we're not showing any imagination about being the first out. Where's our own ecologically based agricultural systems? I know we have lots of R&D in this country, but we've got rid of a lot of it. We've got rid of a lot of the soil science that was there. We don't have very many soil scientists left in Britain. We don't have, I'm not sure we have, the kind of right science yet that some people need in other parts of the world. And we can learn things from other places. And on places, it's not just governments. There are groups in NGOs, there are people in Ethiopia you could look at, there are NGOs working. There are some governments. There is best practice, but we're not collecting it together. And we're not making it transformative. Fair trade is a niche. It doesn't need to be a niche, it needs to transform the way trade is. The good practices we see don't need to be a niche, they need to transform the way we do. And so there's a lot of hope, but it requires a lot more effort than government's putting.
Jeff, could I just ask you, what would do the first steps to reform intellectual property rights in the way that they're distorting what we're talking about? How would you start?
Well, I would...
Perhaps do we need this?
That's right. Well, I mean, what does it need to do to get rid of it?
why was it invented in the first place?
It was invented here as a crown protection for the crown monopoly on printing, wasn't it? And in Venice, and
what I'm saying is, it's all very well to say this is what's the, what did we do about it?
Well, ideally, you would scrap it in the way it exists at the moment, and certainly in terms of agriculture and food. You would remove the monopoly element out of the patent system, out of plant right of protection. You would prevent anyone having a monopoly so there would be a right to use, because what you're allowing at the moment is a right to prevent others using. So that's one thing you could actually do.
The first country that introduced that removes
taking intellectual property rights away from the people who own their own biodiversity?
They don't really have them. They have sovereignty over their own biodiversity. I would not have allowed the patenting of any living organism. That was lazy lawmaking. If you want a form of protection, and I have intellectual property, and I have copyright. But does it achieve what we want? Intellectual property is about economic interest. That's where it's always been at. Whose economic interest is it in to have it and what levels? I would not have had a uniform minimum system, which we have in TRIPS, which removes the opportunities for developing countries to sit, match and mix. Even Keith Maskus, who's one of the, you know, great authority on intellectual property and proponent of it, says for developing countries, strong patent system makes absolutely no sense because they're net importers of technology. We've removed the possibility of them to do what we did, copy ourselves to catch up. So there's a lot of things we need to do, but we need more brains than mine actually looking at this. And we're not asking the right questions. Yours is the right question. Now let's get some people working on how we would do it.
If I may just interject here with one sentence concerning this, I think the lowest hanging fruit is really to not put too many hopes in private research for the development of agricultural research benefiting developing countries. 97% of the patents in biotechnologies are detained by corporations which are based in OECD countries. And, sorry?
Universities now insist on IP rights for people who work.
No, but we need to promote public research which responds not to the needs of the solvent markets of producers from OECD countries and on the crops in which they specialize. We need public research to help the needs of developing countries and smallholders in those countries who cultivate crops for which there is basically no research being done except very poorly financed research. So I think one way, and I'm not in any way contesting the need to change the system, but certainly a first step is to reinvest, to have governments reinvest in public research, because for the moment the research is strongly biased in favor of certain crops and certain countries' needs, which do not correspond to the needs of developing countries and smallholders in those countries. But I have answers on the other issues which were raised.
Janice, were you going to answer ourselves?
Yeah. Yes, I was. Well, at least propose an answer and be satisfied. But I think the evidence points very strongly in Alan Simpson's statement. We have no choice but to reinvent farming and agriculture and the rules under which it operates. We have no choice. The only question is, do we do this in a reasonably well thought out way? Or, as we saw in the response to the food price hike, it happens chaotically and probably to everybody's disadvantage. What we see happening, and I come on to the positive things very quickly, is both private companies that now dominate the sector and sovereign governments in developing countries are seeking to solve the problem by purchasing land in poor countries, getting physical access over phosphorus, over water, over land, over biodiversity. If we don't offer alternatives, we will end up in a terrible geopolitical mess over precisely this response. The time period in which to act and start speaking about this is extremely short, because these things are already happening and they're increasing. Right, so what's happened? Mali, very poor country, you would think on the face of it, living close to the edge of the Sahara doesn't have great agricultural prospects, but it has ambitions to do a lot better for its food resilience than it does now. And it has introduced this year a new law on agriculture, which puts up front and central the sustainability and resilience issue. And part of its guarantee that it will move research and practice in that direction, and we don't really know what the end point is, it's an evolving thing, is to bring in small farmer organizations into direct discussion with agricultural scientists and commercial stakeholders to thrash it out. We cannot find sustainable solutions unless we start creating those required fora for these discussions to take place. So that would be very much the first step. Figure out what works in your own jurisdiction to provide a space where these voices can come together and the different experiences can be pooled. The next thing we see in countries like Peru, and many other parts of the world as well, what you can call areas of heightened autonomy. Very substantial geographic spaces where local governments, indigenous peoples, municipalities are saying, we're going to step out of the global system. We do not believe it will build us a resilient future. And on a spatial, territorial basis, are seeking to build resilient agroecologies that meet their own food needs. Those practices are extraordinarily insightful for their understanding of how to, for example, start, instead of using water use functions, which is what we do here in every part of Europe, start moving towards the management of hydrological cycles and building institutions that over the long term will enable us to do that. And stop using fertilizer and begin to build systems that manage nutrient flows through agrobiology. We need institutions and laws that encourage research and practice to move in that direction. And we have examples of this zones of heightened autonomy. We also see in China, it will not go the route that others have followed. It has not so assigned the plant breeders' right legislation yet, although it's required to do under WTO. It will be seeking its own way of dealing with the modernization of its seed system. And this will break open a lot of our current assumptions. They are investing heavily in what they call agroecological designs. They already have out in the field, you know, pilot ways to start trying, instead of managing agriculture as an industry with a linear throughput of inputs leading to a yield product at the end, of managing sustainable systems and moving to a system-based management of farming. Now, the funny thing about China is, for all its pluses and minuses, once it's figured out the right thing to be doing, it has the power to bring it into practice over very large territorial spaces that will shock those of us who perhaps work on a more, well, we have to listen to all the interests and give a little bit here, and commerce is very strong and they're offering us an alternative and maybe we should go the easy route and just listen to what they say. So I wouldn't be surprised if in the 2050 period, some of the real clues to how to manage this are going to come out of China. They're working very hard on it. They know they have a problem in this area. Look closer to home. Sweden at the national level, the Cornish Food Trust right here in the UK have used the power of public purchase to start getting a grip on changing the system. Schools, hospitals, prisons, anything that is purchasing food for a public institution. Sweden, I think it's 20% by 2015, or 2010 actually, has to be locally supplied from an agroecological production system. And they'll do it. They're well on the way to achieving that. Cornish Food Trust began with supplying hospitals with locally produced food, or organically or fair trade retailers, and is now moving out to build a whole food landscape that can continue to derive recreational and touristic dollars, but also sustain movement in the direction that we're seeking here in this committee.
Well,
I just make the point, I mean, I'm quite sceptical about Chinese attitude to intellectual property rights, but they're the first, and rightly, to insist that no one goes in and takes their biodiversity.
Absolutely.
They're signed the Convention of Biological Diversity, and I was very worried by Jeff Tandy's remark saying that the diversity they didn't own, they do, and they must own it. Otherwise, you're going to have this being lost. So when we say that intellectual property rights need to be banned, goodness sake, let's be clear what we mean by that.
But there's a distinction between ownership and sovereignty.
And
I think that's really crucial.
There are ways to protect that ownership without this becoming subject to the laws of the market.
Yes.
In other terms, the protection against biopiracy is
very important to make this qualification.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not either IP rights or nothing at all. It's a kind of protection which is actually not benefiting private parties detaining private intellectual property rights.
It goes back to the Convention on Biological Diversity in 1992 and the fight over whether resources would be seen from a sustainability point of view or a commercial point of view, and over whether or not you would have this common heritage idea, and that lost. It reaffirmed the national sovereignty, it came about with the introduction of IP rules into the WTO in the 80s, and the sense that the North was extending its control over genetic resources that were sometimes taken from the South in the bioprospecting and used to make pharmaceuticals and making a lot of money. And the South then said, we've got a resource we can make money out of. And that came into the 1992 event. And they became intertwined over the next 20 years with the sense that there was no return to the South for what they perceived as being taken from them and used to make lots of money and no return. It's kind of the biological gold. But there is a lot of evidence that the way the CBD has operated and that the way the intellectual property regime is undermining the capacity of plant breeding globally, because it's turning into the beggar my neighbour approach. It's mine, it's not yours, and you have to pay for it. To survive in agriculture means sharing. And when the International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources was negotiated, following the CBD, prior to that it was based on a common heritage principle that we shared the resources that we had in agriculture, that anyone could get and exchange the genetic materials, because we all benefit from that and small farmers benefit from that. That spilled over into those negotiations and became a big question about, do we want to keep on doing it in that way? Because in other negotiations, the North is taking away from us. These are kind of big political perceptions. And trade negotiators know nothing about biology, and environmental negotiators tend to know nothing about agriculture, and they don't talk to each other very often. And you have different regimes being developed. Now, the intellectual property rules were a major bane of contention in the international treaty negotiations, and for the first time in any treaty, they've been recognised as a problem, because if intellectual property rights are taken out on any of those, then someone has to pay for doing that, because it's recognising it diminishes the general system. Now, what we're seeing is traditional communities, which would often share their knowledge, and there are cases from the Andes, people came from the United States, took the stuff away, and then patented it when they grew it and patented it in the different cases. And then that closes them down. They don't mind giving it away for common good, but they do if someone else is going to take it. And what we're doing is changing the psychology, we're changing the whole dynamic. Within science, it means the lawyers don't want you to go and talk about your results at a conference and show the knowledge, because it might be patentable. The Bayh-Dole Act in the United States actually only benefits two or three of the big universities. Most others spend more money on getting their intellectual property and defending it than they ever will from earning it. The major resource flows from owning intellectual property flow into the United States. It's one of its big foreign exchange earners, $20-25 billion a year. Almost no other country makes money out of it. Just a few do. Look at the work of Keith Maskus. Intellectual property is a fiction. And it's a fiction. Like all good fictions, it's good if it's a good reading, it does you some good. But if it doesn't, or if the good it does you is outweighed by the harm it does others, then we have to rethink it. And that's why I'm saying we have to rethink some of those rules. Within the agricultural framework, they are not facilitating the kind of exchange and sharing that Alan's talking about as being needed. But people are struggling because they recognise that's necessary. They're struggling to find ways through it, but they're complicated, they're legalistic, and they're extremely difficult to actually implement.
Yeah, I don't want to mention, so people, please get back to the question if you want one before the end, and then I want to ask you a question. Okay. Lydia, you can come back if I ask you a question.
Thank you, I'm glad to go. I mean, I think Van Dyne Shiva was right when seeing the face of the old Indian constitution, which made it illegal to take ownership of any living form. And I think that there's a difference between the collective stewardship of the commons and the corporate ownership of what has been privatized. And that's part of the mystery. But what I was intrigued about was the point you made about these zones of heightened autonomy. I think once we start to rip up double Australian rules, the models of sustainability are going to have to be crafted around the interconnectedness of what those autonomous zones are. Now, my question is just a request. I'd really like to read some of the stuff that presumably you've written about that, because it seems to me that that's what we require. We require different models around which to predicate our thinking of how what a sustainable future is like. And it's, those models are just not in any time shape imagination and extension of where we are now. So if it's possible to get...
James will get in touch with you. You've already given us some of your trade cards. It would be very useful to have some of your publications. Open access or however you want to do it.
Interestingly enough, the book I'm going to give you is also freely available on the web and can be downloaded anywhere in the world. That uses within the existing system of copyright, which is Creative Commons.
We'll worry about copyright, yeah. Yes,
Jan. Very briefly.
Thanks, Alan.
It's also interesting when you look around the world for the positive examples. Surprisingly often, they involve a privatized water, drinking water company. And why? They don't want agricultural pollution entering the water supply in the first place. They don't want their groundwater depleted by agricultural extraction. And they don't want their dams silting up from soil runoff from farming methods. They are proving to be some of the most innovative and long-term creative thinkers about how to bring more sustainable natural resource use with productive agricultures that meet the needs of the future.
I'd like to answer your question on the positive examples and what might be ways forward. Two suggestions, which I believe are underestimated in the current debate. One is we need to work on the supply chains. We need to work on governance issues in the relationships between small producers, commodity buyers, food processors, large retailers, and of course the suppliers of inputs. This has been referred to by my colleagues at this table. The system of food production and distribution really resembles an hourglass shape. It has a very small number of input providers, a very large number of producers. Some 500 million households live on small-scale family farming in the world, 2 billion individuals, and a relatively small number of global retailers who have access to the global markets. So it's a very imbalanced power structure in this supply chain. This needs to be addressed by governments, for example, a more aggressive use of competition law, anti-concentration law, labeling requirements, for example, an obligation to identify how much of the percentage of the final price goes to the initial producer, by organizing small-hold farmers in cooperatives in order to improve their bargaining position on that supply chain. And I think the role of the state is crucial in re-regulating the large corporations which are, for the moment, monopolizing power in this system. A second proposal is that we need to pay more attention to the institutional innovations which certain countries have developed in the form of strategies for the realization of the right to food. What does this mean? Three elements are included in these strategies, which are part of what states are obliged to do if they are to realize the right to food. First of all, mapping food insecurity to ensure adequate targeting of their agricultural and food policies in order to identify where the hungry people are. and where the efforts should be put. Secondly, countries in these strategies have developed indicators, benchmarks, defined timelines within which certain objectives should be achieved, and this improves accountability before national parliaments and civil society organizations. And in a number of countries, this has been done very successfully. Thirdly, countries are now developing in certain regions of the world framework laws which guarantee the right to food and empower courts or other independent bodies to monitor the decisions of governments and to ensure that these decisions indeed realize the right to food. For example, Guatemala has adopted a food security and nutrition law in 2005. Brazil has a federal law on food and nutritional security. Indonesia has a food law. And all these countries, and there are a dozen in the world, have moved from saying we need good policies to achieve food security to saying, which is even more important, that every person has a right to adequate food and that to this right there correspond obligations imposed on government. And I think this institutional dimension is hugely important in the panoply of solutions we recommend to countries to achieve food security.
Many thanks. Let me just ask you, is there a question which you answer yes or no? Do you think we could make a difference with the report if we got some of these ideas incorporated in it? Would it make a difference at this stage? What do you say?
Yes, if you followed it up with lobbying as well, which I'm sure you would do.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely, and if you don't make proposals, the answer will be the same one we've always had. We'll simply produce more. We may limit the pressure on prices by producing more, but it will not benefit those who are hungry.
Yes, it's not an option.
Yes, this is the time. There is really no time for 2015.
Well, normally people around here, I think they can take challenges on the chin and get to handle the case. What you have done is start the ball rolling, really, today. You've said so many good things that have enticed us, I'm sure, to think out of our boxes about what kind of things we might do, not just with our own government, but other governments as well. Next time we're meeting on the 11th of March, we're having John Derrington, who's the guy who runs this business sanctioning advisor to the government here, the Prime Minister. We have Joseph Sheran, Peter Hazel, we hope that in the Dissine, Andre Carter, and Camilla Toulmin. And then the next one after that is the 25th of March, when we have Douglas Alexander, the Secretary of State, and Hillary Dent, amongst others. So we're getting hope, we'll get there, we'll have to come now, yeah.
Yes.
And we'll learn something, if these things are going to be enacted, we need to get their support and get them to listen. I'm sure they will, if you talk to them properly. So, okay, that's been a real help. I mean, do you think you've got everything over you wanted to say? If you haven't, please write this, you know.
Yeah.
It's been really, really helpful. You did most of the talking, and what happened with politicians across the table from the often, right? And we're so knowledgeable about something I've talked to you and see you transmitted back to us. So thank you very, very much for coming, and we hope to see some of the cover of the young people in the gallery again back next time. And bring your friends.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I feel like clapping.